How to describe the shape of a manifold? We pursued so far the idea that we use a metric tensor to tell us what the distance is between two neighboring points. Eventually, this will also encode what the distance is between faraway points, and that encodes curvature. The reason is as follows. Imagine this is our manifold, and imagine we draw a right-angled triangle on it. This is not an accident of drawing. This is meant to indicate an actual shortest line. So this could be a wavy manifold, and we follow the and we go the shortest path from this point to that point, and then the shortest path again over there, shortest path over there. But you know, it may not be all that straight. It will look like this. So it's a right-angled triangle. And then in such circumstances, it will generally not be true that a squared plus b squared is c squared. Pythagoras will be violated in a curved background. Therefore, by checking for Pythagoras, we can check whether or not there's curvature. This is basically the way that the metric encodes curvature, encodes the shape of a manifold such as space-time. That's not the only way that curvature can be encoded. Another way to encode it is, or the another way in which the curvature is encoded is in the angles. If you add the sum of the three angles, on flat space you obtain 180 degrees. On curved space you don't. So again, by measuring angle sums, you can check for curvature. These things were known to Helmholtz and Gauss more than 100 years ago, 150 years ago, and they already tried to check whether our actual space-time is flat or not. They did some experiments. Of course, they couldn't measure anything because the deviations were too small, but it was great that they considered the possibility. So in this context, so far we worked with violation of Pythagoras. That's what the GMU does. It eventually just expresses Pythagoras' law and what happens to it when we go to a curved space, or in fact when we change a coordinate system, even on flat space. If we express everything in non-trivial coordinates, then too, Pythagoras looks different. Even though it stays the same in principle, it looks different. Anyway, so we use the metric path to encode distances and therefore the shape and the curvature of a space-time. Here is an alternative idea that is just as useful for general relativity and just as much used. A manifold shape, that is, its curvature, also reveals itself in the non-triviality of parallel transport of vectors on the manifold. So, for example, and I think we discussed that at the very beginning of the course already a little bit, imagine you find yourself standing on the North Pole. Okay, so there you are, on top of the world. And you point straight ahead towards the South Pole. Of course, no matter where you point, you're pointing straight ahead to the South Pole, all right? So you point straight to the South Pole, and then you start walking towards the South Pole. So there you are, standing on the North Pole. And now you walk towards the South Pole, and you parallel transport your arm as you walk, like this. Eventually, you arrive, let's say, at the equator. This is supposed to indicate the equator. It doesn't have to be the equator. It's just some, at some certain latitude, you stop walking. And then you walk sideways, let's say, along the equator or whatever that latitude is. You walk sideways, but as you walk along the equator, you always point with your arm in the same direction. You parallel transport your arm. So you do that, and then you walk backwards all the way to the North Pole. What you will find is that as you arrive back on the North Pole, you're no longer pointing in the same direction as the one that you pointed into when you started your trip. This would have never happened on a flat space. On a flat space, you walk a few steps this direction, walk this way, back and back, you're always pointing in the same direction. So clearly, having observed that you arrive back with your hand pointing in a different, with your arm pointing in a different direction than what you started in, this tells you you walked on a surface that was curved. In this case, the one of a sphere. So what we notice here is that apart from the sum of angles not being 180 degrees, apart from Pythagoras' law being violated, curvature also manifests itself as the non-triviality of parallel transport of vectors. Just try to express all about the curvature in terms of that. By the way, this will not even be the last way that we express curvature. Right? So there are many more ways that you can express curvature. One other way to express curvature of space-time would be in the non-trivial sound that an object makes that has the shape of that curved manifold. Right? The curvature will reflect itself in the sound. And we will ask, does the sound tell us too exactly what the curvature is? Another way to express curvature is to express it in terms of the non-trivial entanglement structure of the ground state. That has something to do, that is basically my work at the moment. And you see there are different ways that curvature can be expressed. Now our focus is on expressing curvature in terms of non-triviality of parallel transport. The key definition here is the following. It's the definition of a covariant derivative. A covariant derivative, indicated with that symbol nabla here, is defined as a map that differentiates a vector field to obtain a vector field, and it differentiates it in the direction of a vector field. So your covariant derivative will need as its input a direction vector field that indicates in which direction we want to differentiate, and a vector field that is the object of the differentiation, and then it will output the differentiated vector field. In fact, it will output sort of the differentiated vector field. Okay, so we feed into our covariant derivative a vector field eta that is to be differentiated, and a vector field psi that indicates the direction in which we want to differentiate. And then it outputs for us the covariant derivative of the vector field eta in the direction of the vector field psi. Any such map which obeys the following two axioms will be called a covariant derivative. It will also be called an affine connection. So the two axioms that such a covariant derivative will obey are as follows. The covariant derivative of a vector field in the direction of a vector field psi must have the property that if we multiply the vector field psi with a function, so not just a number but a function, so we are rescaling, so to speak, the direction vector arbitrarily at different points in space and time, then we want complete linearity with respect to f. We must be able to pull this f directly out of it. Because the psi is really a dumb index here. It just tells us the direction in which we want to differentiate. The psi is not itself to be differentiated. It's just telling us the direction in which we want to differentiate. Therefore, the whole thing should be completely linear with respect to that variable. We want that any scalar function f in front of here can be pulled out of it in front. This will be very useful because later, the contravariant vectors that we will have down here will consist of basis vectors and coefficient functions. And this axiom will tell us that we can pull all coefficient functions directly in front. Okay, so that's the first axiom. The second axiom is that our covariant derivative is supposed to obey a Leibniz rule with respect to the multiplication of the vector field that we want to differentiate with some function. You see, now the f should not be, it should not be possible to simply pull it in front. That would make no sense because we are differentiating here the product of two space-dependent things. So we ought to have a Leibniz rule. So what we want is that the covariant derivative in the direction of the vector phi psi of f times eta, f being some scalar function, eta being some vector field, is given by the covariant derivative acting on f, and we define this, the covariant derivative of a function in the direction of psi simply to be the psi of f. So the covariant derivative on a function is simply the directional derivative on the function, plus what we obtain when we leave the f alone and have the covariant derivative act on the vector field instead. Simple Leibniz rule as usual. Covariant derivative applied to the product is covariant derivative applied to the f alone, that's this business, plus leaving f alone here and applying the covariant derivative on that instead. Keep in mind this little point here. We define the covariant derivative of a function f in the direction of the vector phi psi to be simply the directional derivative of f in the direction of psi, which is psi applied to f. So for functions, the covariant derivative is just the ordinary derivative. So any such map obeying those two axioms, linearity in the direction, complete linearity in the direction, and Leibniz rule for vector fields multiplied with functions, is called a covariant derivative or an affine connection. There were questions last time about how that differs from the Lie derivative. For you, I have some extra comparison discussion with the Lie derivative on the side that you're welcome to study and ask me questions about if you like. So for now, let us assume that this is the starting point. Forget about the metric for now. Let's say we don't know about metrics. All we know about our spacetime is a covariant derivative. We only know that nabla operation. We only know that affine connection. And metric is not defined. As we will later see, the metric and the affine connection have to be consistent with each other. Otherwise, one could describe a bump where the other one doesn't see one. So they have to be consistent with each other, but they can actually stand on their own. We can either work with only one or the other. So for now, let's just work only with the covariant derivatives, only with the affine connections. And we will describe the shape of a manifold entirely in terms of this affine connection. So how then does the affine connection look like in a chart? Let us choose bases in the tangent space in the usual lazy way. We just choose a coordinate system and then we get served with it a basis for the tangent spaces. Remember, we don't have to choose that basis, but let's choose it for now. Then, given a covariant derivative nabla, let us see how it acts on those basis vectors. So for example, what is the covariant derivative of the vector field given by this basis, by these basis vectors, in the direction of those basis vectors? You know, this is the tangent field and that's a tangent field. What's the covariant derivative of this with respect to that? I mean, in this direction. Well, we have to make a choice here. It depends on what manifold we want to have. We make our choice by defining a coefficient function here that gives us the output vector field. Remember, a covariant derivative of a vector field is a vector field. So it's got to be a linear combination of these guys. So therefore, the covariant derivative of that vector field in the direction of this vector field has to be some linear combination of these. And we can always write this as some gamma k contracted with that index k, and then indices ij, because there's an I, there's a j over here. So there's going to be some coefficient function there are going to be some coefficient functions, and then, well, this whole thing is just a tangent vector. There is no physics or really math content in this. It's just a definition of one of those covariant derivatives. It turns out that once we specify those coefficient functions, we have already automatically specified everything about that covariant derivative. And the reason is that if we want to calculate now the covariant derivative, not in this direction, but in a direction that is a linear combination of those, well, then we can use this axiom here that tells us how to deal with coefficient functions. We can pull it out. If we want to know how the covariant derivative acts on linear combinations of those with coefficient functions, then again, it's just functions multiplying vectors, and we know that there's a Leibniz rule that takes care of this. So therefore, in order to specify for a given differentiable manifold an affine connection, we only have to pull one of these out of the hat. We just define a function like that. Totally up to us what we define. And then we can use the axioms to extend its definition for arbitrary vector fields that are to be differentiated, and arbitrary vector fields that indicate the direction. And since we use the axioms to construct it, by construction it's going to be an affine connection that obeys the axiom. Those gamma kij functions are also called the Christoffel symbols, and they are also called the connection coefficients. So now let's see how this all works out explicitly. Let's say we want to work out the coefficient, the covariant derivative of a vector field eta in the direction of a vector field xi, assuming that we have already made that definition here. We've chosen some function, some coefficient function gamma kij. Okay, how do we do that? Well, we spell out what those vectors are. The xi is a tangent vector field, so it's xi I, and these are the basis vectors. The eta is a tangent vector field, it has coefficient functions eta j, and these are the basis vectors. Now we use the first axiom, which tells us that this is a coefficient, that since this is just a coefficient function, a scalar function multiplying a vector here, we can pull it in front. So we can pull this out, and we have our first result here. Now we recognize that these are coefficient functions multiplying vectors. Axiom 2 of affine connections says that this is the covariant derivative in this direction. The covariant derivative of such a product is the covariant derivative acting on this, leaving that alone, plus leaving this alone, covariantly differentiating that. Where, if you remember, the covariant derivative acting on a coefficient function, well, is really just the vector field acting on the coefficient function. It's just the directional derivative. Okay, so the xi I is in front of everything, and then the bracket here is working out what that covariant derivative is. What is it? Okay, so we have, first of all, to differentiate the eta. Covariantly differentiating the eta is to calculate the eta in the direction calculate the direction derivative of eta in the direction of that vector field, which is obtained by differentiating just d by dx. I mean, eta j comma I is just the partial derivative of eta j in the I direction. In the I direction because we have d by dx I here. And then we left that vector here the same. We left it alone. It's reoccurring over here. And then the second term by the Leibniz rule is leaving this alone and covariantly differentiating that. But we know what that is. We defined it just in the line above. It's the covariant derivative of this basis vector in the direction of that basis vector. Covariant derivative of this basis vector in the direction of that basis vector. It's all of this stuff. Goes in here. So therefore, we you obtain in the next line that the covariant derivative of eta in the direction of xi is given by the xi times the eta, xi times the eta being partially differentiated. And I'm pulling that partial derivative out here. I renamed the variable j, k here, just so that it matches the same notation as here. And then we have here an eta and a gamma. That's the eta and the gamma. And the xi comes from here. So overall, what does it do to the coefficients, to the coefficient functions? Well, what we obtain is that the coefficient functions eta k, when we differentiate, when we covariantly differentiate in the direction of, let's say, in the direction of I, is obtained by differentiating the coefficient function in the direction of I ordinarily, partial derivative, that's this piece here, plus, and then we get the eta with the gamma. So this is what happens with the coefficient function, and this is what happens if we spell everything out. And here we introduced a notation, which is that is this semicolon. Sorry, it looks a little like an I, but for an I, this should be curving this way around, okay? So a semicolon, as opposed to a comma, a semicolon means covariant differentiation. So the covariant, under covariant differentiation, the coefficient functions of a vector field behave this way, that they acquire this new index here, and it's obtained by ordinary differentiation plus these terms with the Christoffel symbols. Another way to write it is to say that the covariant derivative of eta in the direction of xi is given by coefficients xi I. Remember, this is purely linear. Can pull this in front, xi I. And then it's these coefficients here, which are just those, covariant differentiation of the coefficient functions, that's two terms, this one and that one, and that is contracted with the partial derivative here, that's this piece there. What is important to note about this is that those coefficient functions, gamma, k, I, j, do not behave like any other coefficient functions we've seen before, because they don't transform in the way that tensors would if we change coordinate systems and change bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces along with that. So it seems that those guys are not coefficient functions of a tensor. We will later find out, much later, well, not all that much later, in a few hours, we will find out what exactly they are. They are not tensors, but they will be sort of form-value tensors. Anyway, what these things are, they are not tensors. And we can see that already by checking their transformation properties when we change coordinate system and we change bases along with that. Change bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces along with it in the usual way. See, on one hand, we can calculate the covariant derivative of the new basis vectors in the direction of the new basis vectors in the tangent space as we change coordinate system from the x to the x tildes. We can calculate it and calculate this in two ways. I will calculate it in two ways, and from that we can deduce the transformation rules for the gamma. Okay, so we are in a new coordinate system and we calculate the gamma bar. We calculate what those gammas are in the new coordinate system. For that purpose, we take the new coordinate system's basis vectors, d by dx bar, different covariantly differentiate them in the direction of the new direction vectors. This is by definition the gamma bar coefficients contracted with the basis. And we do know already how those basis vectors can be expressed in terms of the old basis vectors in the unbarred coordinate system. Namely, this is equal to that. There's just the Jacobi matrix in between, right? That's easy. Okay, so all we've done is we've expressed what this is by definition, And then we've used the transformation law of these basis vectors, which is really just the chain rule, to express them in terms of the basis vectors in the unbarred coordinate system. On the other hand, we can also do the following. We can say this expression can be worked out using the axioms 1 and 2 of our affine connection. First of all, we write out that basis vector in terms of the chain rule as a linear combination of the old basis vectors. So here are just the here's just the Jacobi matrix of coefficient functions. And these are just functions, coefficient functions, right? So we will be able to pull them in front. Also, this vector here can be expressed using the chain rule in that way. And these are coefficient functions. We can apply the Leibniz rule to differentiate this product. So what do we obtain? First of all, we can pull that matrix in front, total linearity. So we have that in front now, and we covariant to differentiate in the direction of the old basis vectors. Now we use the Leibniz rule. These are functions, these are vectors. And we obtain the following. This prefactor multiplies everything. And the covariant derivative of that product is in this square bracket. We obtain the covariant derivative of these coefficient functions, leaving that alone as the first term. So we do the covariant derivative of these coefficient functions, but that is just the ordinary derivative of functions, because the covariant derivative on functions is the ordinary derivative of functions. So it's just that times this, we just carry that forward here. And then the next term is obtained by leaving that alone, carrying this one forward, and then applying the covariant derivative on that. So we carry this one forward to here. And then we have the covariant derivative of an old basis vector in the direction of an old basis vector. And that we know what it is. That's just given by this gamma. Okay. Now let's simplify this a little bit. Notice that dx by dx bar, d by dx, simplifies because this and that just goes away, and we have d by dx bar a. That's this expression here. That is carried forward from here. Plus this times that, that's written over here. So now let's compare what we have. We calculated this expression in two ways. We found that it is equal to this, and we found that it is equal to that. So therefore, we have a relationship now between the gamma bar and the gamma. We obtain that the gamma bar is therefore the gamma bar multiplied with, you know, here, the gamma bar multiplied with this Jacobian factor is equal to this piece plus that piece, and that's over here, that's this piece plus that piece. If we multiply from the right with the inverse of that matrix, then we obtain a clean formula just for the gamma bar in terms of the gamma. We obtain two terms here. This one, which does not depend on the gamma, and that one that does depend on the gamma. You notice that the transformation properties of the gamma, as indicated in this term, are just as if gamma was the coefficient matrix of a tensor that's one-fold contravariant and two-fold covariant. It just has the right Jacobi matrices. However, this piece should not be there if the gammas were coefficient functions of a tensor. In fact, it completely screws things up because it's not dependent on gamma at all. What this means is that, for example, if in one coordinate system, the gamma were equal to zero, it just stays completely zero, then in another coordinate system, it may be non-zero, because these guys can contribute stuff out of nothing. Okay? You can always change your coordinate system in such a space and time dependent way that you get funny gammas coming up, even though in the original coordinate system there were no gamma at all. This could never happen for a tensor. If a tensor vanishes in one coordinate system, it's vanishing everywhere. It's just zero. After all, it's coordinate system independent. So clearly something is up with this gamma, it's not a tensor. Well, it's an affine connection, and what we've seen is that the coefficient functions of an affine connection do not transform like the coefficient functions of any kind of tensor. Now, physicists are pragmatic about it and would say that any set of n to the third functions organized in this way as a Christoffel symbol, which transforms in this funny way, will be called an affine connection. That's another way of defining it. So you say that anything that transforms this way is an affine connection. But it's not such a clever definition because it doesn't tell you what the axioms are. It doesn't tell you what the abstract properties are. It's much better to start with properties 1 and 2. You know, these. Much better to know these things because you can easily derive other properties from that. Anyway, so this would be the physicist's definition of an affine connection. Now let's define the absolute covariant derivative. Very easy to define. Consider the covariant derivative of a tensor, but simply delay the choice of the direction in which you want to differentiate. Just don't specify. So we covariantly differentiate a vector field absolutely by doing the following. We do the covariant derivative, so that would give us another tensor field, would give us another tangent vector field, but we do not specify in which direction we want to differentiate. That means that the output of our absolute covariant derivative still has an open slot for a vector field. It waits for a direction vector field to be told in which direction it is to differentiate. But anything that needs a covariant vector field as input, anything that needs a tangent vector field as input is a covariant vector field. So the absolute covariant derivative maps vector fields into 1-1 tensors. You still have to feed it a vector field in order to get a one tensor out of it, to get a contravariant vector field out of it. Concretely, it's not that difficult. The absolute covariant derivative maps a vector field eta that we want to differentiate into the absolute derivative of eta, which is, by definition, obtained by taking the coefficient functions of the covariant derivative. So it's eta k, that's the original coefficient functions, and then with the semicolon we get those two terms, remember, coefficient functions. And then we have the tensor product of the covariant basis and the contravariant basis. This thing is waiting for a direction vector field to be input. That direction vector field will eat up this dxi, and we're left with a vector field. Let's try this out explicitly. Let's say we take the absolute covariant derivative of eta and feed it a direction vector field xi. Okay, so we take the absolute covariant derivative of eta, and we are feeding it a direction vector field xi. This is taking the coefficient function over here. Now we have to take this thing, that's the absolute covariant derivative of eta, and we feed it now the xi. So we have to feed the xi into this. Okay, so I just carry forward all of this and write it here. And then I'm feeding the Xi into that covariant index over here, into that covariant basis over here. But what is that? The dxi applied to a vector field Xi. Dxi applied to a vector field Xi is, of course, by definition, the Xi applied to the coefficient function. That's how differentials of a function were defined. And that is, well, Xi is coefficient function Xi j, d by dxj, xi, that's a Kronecker delta. You just get an xj times Kronecker delta, that's just xi I. So overall, what we obtain is that this is eta k semicolon I, and then all of this simply reduces to xi I. And this is just coefficient functions, and they multiply these tangent vectors. Overall, this is a tangent vector field, namely, it's the covariant derivative of eta in the direction of xi. Okay, so the absolute covariant derivative of eta, when fed the direction vector xi, gives us the covariant derivative of eta in the direction of xi. We defined the covariant derivative algebraically, as we usually do. We define derivatives first algebraically, so that we get their key properties straight from the beginning. And then we check what they mean geometrically. In this case, it will be quite useful. It will be essential, really, to also understand what the geometric definition, what the definition of the covariant derivative means geometrically. Okay, so what is the geometric meaning of the covariant derivative of the affine connection? Remember the very beginning of this lecture when I said that curvature can be expressed in terms of parallel transport. Now we start getting into that. Assume that a covariant derivative, an affine connection, is given. Now, let's say this is the manifold, and we choose a path, gamma, in that manifold. So here's our path. As time passes, I mean, we choose some path parameter t, which you can think of as time if you like. So as the path is traveled, we at some point reach the point p. Then a tangent vector field eta, which is in principle defined everywhere in the manifold, we look at, in particular, at the point P now. And this vector is supposed to indicate what the vector field's vector is at that point P. So then a tangent vector field eta is called orthoparallel along the path gamma at the point P if the covariant derivative of the vector field in the direction of the path, which is to say in the direction of gamma dot being the t derivative of the position on the path, which is a tangent vector, if you remember, according to the geometric definition, is equal to zero. So in other words, a vector field eta is called orthoparallel along the path gamma if the covariant derivative of it vanishes in the direction of the path. And we will think of this as saying that the vector field eta is such that as you look at the vectors that that the vector field has at this point, at that point, at that point, at that point, and so on. These vectors are all pointing in some direction, okay? And if you calculate the covariant derivative of our vector field along the path as you go along, and if that covariant derivative always comes out zero, then we say that this vector is being parallel transported. So a vector field is orthoparallel along a path if its vectors are parallel translates of each other, as verified by calculating the covariant derivative of the vector field along that path. So if the vector field doesn't change in the sense of its derivative is zero, if it doesn't change along the path. Okay, so in this sense, we are using the affine connection to define what we mean by parallel transport. Let's look at that explicitly in a chart. Our vector field is some coefficient functions multiplied with the basis vectors. Our path is parameterized by values that run from A to B, let's say, and it's mapping those values into points of the manifold. We call these points that lie in the interval from A to B, let's say T, and we can speak of it as, and we can speak of this parameter as a time variable, even though it need not have to do anything with the time variable in the manifold. So the path is x is given by the points xi of t. The tangent vectors, according to the geometric definition of what a tangent vector is, the tangent vectors along the path are given by gamma dot of x of t, which is dxk by dt, dxk. Remember, this is just the geometric definition of what tangent vectors are. So now let's write down this autoparallel condition. What is the condition for a vector field to be autoparallel along a path? What does it mean that vectors along a path are parallel transported, therefore? Okay, so we have a vector field eta given by those coefficients, and we have the tangent vectors along a path, which indicate the direction in which we want to differentiate. And the autoparallel condition is that that is vanishing on every point of the path. We can spell all of this out. Remember that the tangent vector is given by this expression over here. So it's just dxk by dt, d by dxk. This is a coefficient function. We will be able to pull it in front. That's what we do over here. And here we have, again, a coefficient function times basis vector. We can use the Leibniz rule here. Covariant derivative applied to that product. This thing is carried forward, stands in front of everything. And the covariant derivative of that product is given by the covariant derivative of this, which is just the ordinary derivative of it, because this is coefficient functions. So that's just this. Carrying that forward, plus leaving that alone and covariantly differentiating this direction vector in the direction of that direction vector. And that's just given by the gamma matrix contracted with these basis vectors. Here we have dxk by dxk that just cancels out, and we have a simplification here. I'm pulling that derivative in front of everything. And then we have this expression here. For eta to be autoparallel, which is to say for its vectors to be parallel transported along the path, this has to be equal to zero. Since these guys are basis vectors, all of those coefficients have to vanish. I mean, for each I, this bracket has to vanish. So we obtain the autoparallel equation that d eta I by dt plus this is equal to zero. So this is the condition for a vector field, which is specified by specifying the coefficient functions eta, to be autoparallel along a path. Now imagine, consider the following question. Can we always parallel transport a vector? Let's say we start out at the point P, and we have geodesics will be coming later. We have a path that runs through a point P. At the point P, we have a tangent vector. How would we parallel transport it? Is there always a vector field such that this vector at the point P is autoparallel, such that the vector field is autoparallel and starts out with that vector over there? Well, all we have to check is this differential equation here. The eta j are the to-be-found coefficient functions for the vector field that is supposed to be autoparallel. It's supposed to be consisting of, you know, vectors that are parallel transported along the path. So what we need to find is the eta j of x along the path. What we do know is those gammas, because we chose them, right? So we chose what the gammas are, and that was our choice of how the manifold looks like. So we know what the gamma I, k, j are as functions of x. And we chose also what the path is. So now we have an ordinary differential equation here for the coefficient functions eta. We have several coupled ordinary differential equations for the coefficients functions eta. Simply along this path, so for this parameter t, we have differential equations for those coefficient functions eta I. And what kind of differential equation is it? Well, it's a linear differential equation in eta, and there are several coefficients functions eta, but there are no partial derivatives for the eta. So it's just an ordinary differential equation of first order, which means if we know the initial conditions, we can integrate up that differential equation by certain theorems from the theory of ordinary differential equations. If you have a differential equation like that with the coefficient functions all smooth, etc., we assume these things to be smooth, of course, then if you know what the vector field is at the point P, then you are setting the initial condition for this differential equation. It has only up to first derivative. One initial condition is sufficient. So if you know what the vector is at the point P, this differential equation will uniquely determine what its parallel transport will be, at least for a finite distance. So that's guaranteed. So therefore, our affine connection really tells us, using this autoparallel equation, how to parallel transport any vector from anywhere to anywhere. Okay, so this is just written it up in words. First order differential equation, ordinary differential equation. If we're given the initial condition, we can calculate the solution. And the proposition is that given a path in the manifold, the autoparallel transport, or in physics lingo, it's just parallel transport of a tangent vector eta at a point of the manifold gamma of t to a later point in the path, gamma of s, is unique. And we can it is useful to give this parallel transport a name. Let's call it tau. So if we choose a path gamma in our manifold, and let's assume that the Christoffel symbols have been chosen once and for all, then already the parallel transport is completely specified. The parallel transport from a point T on the path to a later point, at a later time, let's say S on the path, is a map from the tangent space at the point gamma of T to the tangent space at the point gamma of S. And it's mapping tangent vectors into tangent vectors at the first tangent space to tangent vectors at the later tangent space. And we can now make a tremendously great use of this by using it to define the covariant derivative also as a Newton-Leibniz epsilon going to zero limit. Remember, we originally started by defining the covariant derivative algebraically, so the axioms that it obeyed. But now that we found out that the affine connection, the covariant derivative, defines parallel transport for us, now we can define the covariant derivative also using a Newton-Leibniz limit. And that will be tremendously useful because it will allow us to extend the definition of the covariant derivative so that the covariant derivative can not only act on tangent vectors, but also cotangent vectors and arbitrary tensors. Okay, so here's how we can define the covariant derivative as a Newton-Leibniz limit. Imagine this is the manifold, here's a path. Here's a point gamma of s. And we have a tangent vector field that lives everywhere in the manifold, and in particular, it lives on that path. Now let's say we want to define what is the covariant derivative of that tangent vector field at that point in the direction indicated by the path. Well, what we can do is we can use Newton and Leibniz's original idea. And we can say we take the value of the vector field over here, subtract the value of the vector field over there, and divide that by the distance. And then let the limit of the distance going to zero happen. In principle, this is hard to do because how do we compare a vector here with a vector over there? They live in different tangent spaces. However, the parallel transport provides us a shape-intrinsic way of comparing vectors here to vectors there. We simply parallel transport them along. So what we do is, in order to subtract a vector here from a vector there, first we take the vector over here and we parallel transport it to that tangent space over here. Then we take the difference between those two vectors that are now in the same tangent space, divide by the path parameter, and then let the path parameter go to zero. So here's the definition. The covariant derivative of a vector field at some point on the path, in the direction tangential to the path, is by definition the ordinary Newton-Leibniz derivative. So, value here minus value over there, and so on. Of what we obtain when we parallel transport the vector field in the direction of parallel transported in the direction of the path. I will not go through the details of of the proof why this is equivalent to the algebraic definition. It is, for example, in the textbook by Straumann. Remember that notice that this is a definition that allows us to differentiate in all directions because we are free to choose any path we want. We can next time choose a different path in the manifold and then we get a differentiation in a different direction. This is the geometric definition of the covariant derivative of a vector field. We can use this idea to define now the covariant derivative for arbitrary tensors. Okay, so what we have is that the parallel transport map tau, which maps from a point s on the manifold to a gamma of s to the, of the manifold to a point gamma of t on the manifold, transports tangent vectors from the point gamma s to the point gamma t. But this induces for us automatically also parallel transport for cotangent vectors. How so? Well, we simply have to require that parallel transport commutes with evaluation. Remember, a tangent vector and a cotangent vector can evaluate on each other. A cotangent vector is simply a linear map of tangent vectors into numbers. So we require the parallel transport of cotangent vectors to be such that it doesn't matter whether we first evaluate a cotangent vector on a tangent vector, or we first parallel transport the two of them and let them evaluate then. So let's say eta is a tangent vector, omega is a cotangent vector at some point, then they evaluate on each other to give you a number. Instead, we could also parallel transport our tangent vector and parallel transport our cotangent vector, and then we obtain a new tangent vector, a new cotangent vector, and they live in the same at the same point, and we can evaluate them onto each other, and that's supposed to give the same number. This is the defining equation for what that is, the parallel transport of a cotangent vector. And once we have that, once we know how to parallel transport tensors, once we know how to parallel transport tangent vectors and cotangent vectors, then we can parallel transport anything, any tensors. So in particular, the parallel transport of the product of two tensors, be they contravariant, covariant, or mixed, is simply by definition the parallel transport of the tensor product of the parallel transports. Really the only sensible way to define it. So now we can define the covariant derivative of arbitrary tensors. Not just differential forms, just arbitrary tensors. So let's say S is an arbitrary tensor and P is some arbitrary point of the manifold, and we want to differentiate that tensor field in the direction of some arbitrary tangent vector psi. By definition, this is the covariant derivative in the direction of a path that happens to run through the point P with gamma dot happening to be the tangent vector to the path, which is in the direction that we want to differentiate. So we just choose a path that runs through the point P with a tangent that is exactly the vector that we want to differentiate, in whose direction we want to differentiate. And this is by definition the Newton-Leibniz limit of what we obtain when we parallel transport a tensor from the initial point P to a little bit later, and just the Newton-Leibniz limit of that. It doesn't matter exactly which path we choose for that, as long as the path is such that at t equals 0, we run through the point P, and the tangent vector gamma dot happens to be xi at that point. Then similarly to what we did before, we can define the absolute covariant derivative of a tensor field simply by delaying the choice of the direction vector field in which direction we want to differentiate. So the absolute covariant derivative of a tensor field is something that feeds on a certain number of contravariant inputs, a certain number of covariant inputs. Let's say if S is a PR tensor, it's a P-fold covariant, R-fold contravariant tensor, then it wants to feed on P tangent vectors and R cotangent vectors. And since it's the absolute covariant derivative, it is also still waiting for another vector field to tell it in which direction to differentiate. So that's another input at the end, that's the xi. And this is, by definition, once we feed all of this in there, by definition, this is the covariant derivative of that tensor field when we feed it, you know, the p tangent vectors and the r cotangent vectors. It's just saying delayed choice of xi. All right. Properties of the covariant derivative. The covariant derivative, now not only on vector fields, but generally, covariant derivative is a derivation. And that is ultimately because of that definition that we acquired most recently, the definition of the covariant derivative as a Newton-Leibniz limit, as a Newton-Leibniz kind of derivative. And any Newton-Leibniz derivative has the Leibniz rule, of course. So the covariant derivative of the tensor product of two tensors is given by the Newton-Leibniz derivative of the parallel transport with the parameter S of the tensor product of those two tensors. But that is, by linearity, simply the derivative of the tensor product of the parallel transported tensors. And then we can apply that piecewise by the Leibniz rule, and we get the derivative of the first tensor factor, leaving the second alone, plus vice versa. And that is, of course, just the covariant derivative of the first tensor, tensor the second, plus the other way around. a key takeaway message from this, I mean, if all of this looks a little abstract, let me just tell you one upshot of all of this. What this means is that performing a covariant derivative and performing contractions commute. Okay, so it doesn't matter whether you first contract indices and then covariant differentiate, or you first covariant differentiate and then contract. That's what we are saying here. If you remember, we said early on when we went beyond covariant differentiating tangent vector fields, when we defined what the covariant derivative or the affine connection for a cotangent vector field is, we said we define it in such a way that it doesn't matter whether we first evaluate tangent and cotangent vector on each other, and then parallel transport, or first parallel transport, and then contract. That was the starting point for how we went beyond the covariant derivative of just tensors, tangent vectors, to covariant differentiating cotangent vectors and then all tensors. So that's just a useful takeaway message from all of this. Okay, so how does it look like in a chart then? We have the cotangent, we have the, I don't know. I'm starting to mix up words. Maybe oxygen is running low in here. Okay, so what is the action of a covariant derivative on tensors in a chart? Remember, the covariant derivative of a basis vector like that is given by this expression here. And we got to choose what the gammas are. By choosing the gammas, we chose what the parallel transport looks like on a manifold. In other words, we chose the shape of the manifold. We chose where the bumps are by choosing this function gamma k li. Right. Now, what is the covariant derivative, not of that tangent vector, but what is the covariant derivative of this cotangent vector? According to our abstract definitions, we have it already. Let's see what it works out to explicitly. To this end, in order to covariantly differentiate a cotangent vector, Let us consider the tensor product of a tangent vector field and a cotangent vector field. The idea is we use now this axiom earlier, where we said that if we first evaluate two vectors onto each other, or whether we first parallel transport the two vectors, the tangent and the cotangent vector, and then have them evaluate on each other, same output. Let's try that. So we have here a tangent vector field and we have a cotangent vector field. Let us differentiate the tensor product of the two. We know that we have a Leibniz rule for this. So the covariant derivative of eta tensor omega is the covariant derivative of eta tensor omega plus eta tensor covariant derivative of omega. Where, honestly, we don't quite know yet how that works. This is what we want to work out now. But clearly, the Leibniz rule forces us to this equation. Now, let us contract indices. So let us have the vectors act on each other, and let us use the fact that the covariant differentiation and the contraction commute. So now we calculate what the covariant derivative in the direction of xi is of what we obtain when we have omega actually fed the eta. So we just apply the one on the other. This is a scalar function. Okay, cotangent vector eating up a tangent vector. That gives us a number at each point. That's the scalar function on the manifold. And the covariant derivative in the direction xi of a scalar function is, of course, just the directional derivative of that scalar function in the direction of xi. So it's just xi of that function. All right. So now, by the Leibniz rule, what we have is that this will be the omega left alone and the covariant derivative applied to this, plus the covariant derivative applied to the first one, and then leaving the eta alone from here. So making use of this equality, we can also write it like that. We can write that xi of that scalar function is given by this, and that just carries forward. Now, this is the thing we're interested in. What's the covariant derivative of omega in the direction of xi? Let's just solve that equation for it. So we have here covariant derivative of omega in the direction of xi applied to eta. So that's this thing is equal to that minus this. Okay, I'm just putting this over there. Or actually, I'm putting this over here, that over there, and a minus sign of the whole thing. Okay, so it's this equation. Again, looks a little abstract, but let's choose particular cotangent vector fields. For the omega, let's choose basis vectors dxj. For the eta, let's choose basis vectors d by dxi. And now let's plug it all into here and see what expires. Okay, so the covariant derivative in the direction of xi, in the direction of xi of omega, which is dxj, applied to eta, which is d by dxi, is given by xi applied to the inner product of omega on eta, which we will denote with a square, sort of a bracket, like a quantum mechanical bracket. It's simply the evaluation of a cotangent vector on a tangent vector, or generally of a p-form onto a p-form. We can write inner products always in this bracket notation. I don't know why I chose to introduce it at this point, but we might as well do it here. So this is just the evaluation of a cotangent vector on a tangent vector. And in this case, that's just a Kronecker delta. So while this in general is some general function of space and time, in this special case where we chose for these basis vectors and those dual basis vectors, this is just a Kronecker delta But then the directional derivative of a Kronecker delta is always zero, so this thing goes away. And we are simply left with this. But we can work out what that is. That is the the xi coefficient functions because of complete linearity of the covariant derivative, pull in front. So we get here the xi l. And then we have the covariant derivative of d by d xi I, or d by d xi l, of d by d xi, that's those Christoffel symbols. Overall, this bracket, remember, indicates the evaluation of a cotangent vector on a tangent vector. This just gives us a Kronecker delta of j and k. So overall, this just gives us those coefficient functions here. So what we see is that the covariant derivative of a basis vector in the cotangent space in the direction of xi is given by this expression. Very similar to the covariant derivative of a basis vector d by dxi, a basis vector of the tangent space in the direction of xi, except that in that case, there wasn't a minus, there was a plus. And also the index structure was, of course, a little different because we had a lower index over here, which was contracting with that. But other than that, it looked the same. And remember, this was the starting point for introducing affine connections. It was the starting point for introducing covariant derivatives. We started out by saying what the covariant derivative is of a basis vector in the direction of a basis vector. And that's how we introduced the Christoffel symbols. We did it for the tangent vectors. Now we see how that induces automatically also the covariant derivative for cotangent vectors. So this just confirms that once we define what the parallel transport of tangent vectors is, we also implicitly define what the parallel transport is for cotangent vectors and arbitrary tensor fields. And remember how the parallel transport of tangent vectors induced the parallel transport of cotangent vectors? It induced it because we linked up the two by saying that whether we first evaluate tangent and cotangent vectors or whether we first parallel transport the two shouldn't make a difference when we evaluate them against each other. That linked the cotangent vector's parallel transport to the tangent vector's parallel transport, and that is what ultimately determined this law for the parallel transport of tangent vectors. Now, for general tensors, we have that the same strategy works just as above, except that we have to work with many more components. So instead of taking the covariant derivative of the tensor product of just one tensor and one tangent vector field and one cotangent vector field, we take the tensor product of several of them, and then we contract indices. We require that the contraction of the indices commutes with the parallel transport or commutes with the calculation of the affine connection. And this determines, in the same way as what we just did, the transformation rule or the parallel transport rule, the action of the affine connection on arbitrary tensors for arbitrary directions. So for arbitrary tensors, here is the derivation. Let's not go through the details of that. It's very similar to what we had above. Eventually, we make again the choice of particular basis vectors for the cotangent vector space, for the tangent vector space. And then we write our arbitrary tensor as coefficient functions, which are scalar functions, multiplying the basis vectors. And then we obtain that the covariant derivative of our arbitrary tensor is given by this expression here. And that's important. The covariant derivative of an arbitrary tensor expressed in this way is obtained by taking the coefficient function of that tensor, this one, this matrix, huge matrix of coefficient functions, contracting it with the coefficient functions xk of our direction vector. And applying here the semicolon k law, which is the covariant derivative applied to those coefficient functions. This k is being contracted with that k over there, where the key thing about this is, of course, how the semicolon is evaluated. And the semicolon covariant derivative on coefficient functions for arbitrary tensors comes out to be this expression over here, which is that first you take your coefficient function and you ordinarily differentiate them in the k direction. So it's d by dxk of the coefficient function. Plus, and then you get a bunch of terms with plus signs for each of the contravariant indices. So you don't differentiate the coefficient function for that purpose. You just write down the coefficient function. And then you contract it with Christoffel symbols. And you get one contraction here, first in the first position of the tensor's coefficient function, then for the second coefficient, and so on, up until the last coefficient over there. Each of those gets contracted with the Christoffel symbol over there. And then you get a bunch of terms where you have minus the Christoffel symbol, and there you have to contract lower indices of your coefficient functions with the upper index of the Christoffel symbol. So that's overall what you get as the transformation law for the coefficient functions of tensors if you choose to change bases when you change coordinate system. Just one more reason to not necessarily change bases in your tangent spaces when you change coordinate systems. If you don't change bases as you change coordinate systems, you don't have to do that. Right? Not only you don't have to, you cannot do it. It's not right. This law is induced not by change of coordinates. It's induced by change of bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces. Okay. Okay, special cases, tangent vector fields. So all of this, of course, applies to the case where we choose to change bases in the tangent and cotangent vector spaces along with the change of coordinates. So tangent vector fields. Tangent vector fields are given by coefficient functions xi I in the canonical basis of the d by dxi that come with the basis, with the coordinate system. And their coefficient vector, a coefficient functions xi I under covariant differentiation have this rule for the semicolon. It's the ordinary differentiation plus, and then you leave your coefficient functions the same, and you have this gamma matrix here with a plus sign because it's contravariant. For cotangent vector fields, the covariant differentiation, the semicolon, will do the following to the coefficient functions. Again, ordinary derivative. That's why it's just an ordinary comma. And then minus, and then you have the unchanged coefficient function, and again, Christoffel symbols, in each case suitably contracted. So this is contracted upwards, that is contracted downwards. Now I will end with a very quick preview of what comes next. Remember that the covariant derivative was introduced for a particular purpose. Its purpose is to capture the curvature or the shape of a space-time. In fact, generally, space-time has more than just curvature. It could also have torsion. And the affine connection is meant to capture that, namely by capturing the non-triviality of parallel transport of vectors and covectors and tensors on the manifold. But how do we extract from the knowledge of the affine connection what the curvature is of the manifold, what its shape is? And for that purpose, there will be certain key definitions coming up. We don't have time for this today. We are basically at the end of it today. But let me just quickly indicate how this is going. First of all, assume that Xi1, Xi2, and Xi3 are three tangent vector fields. Then, using the affine connection, we can define the so-called torsion map and the so-called curvature map. And these two maps will encode everything about the shape of the manifold. The torsion map is defined as a map that maps two vector fields into another vector field. And it does it by calculating the covariant derivative of one vector field in the direction of the other, minus the other way around, minus the commutator of the two vector fields. Not obvious what that's good for. We will see. And the curvature map is even more complicated. It takes as input three tangent vector fields, and it will map them into another tangent vector field. Here, you're doing the covariant derivatives in two directions, one after the other, and then you take the opposite of that, and again, minus the covariant derivative of the commutator. So what are these things really doing? Roughly speaking, the torsion map is measuring non-triviality of closed path closure, or just, well, of parallelogram closure. And the curvature is mapping, the curvature map is checking for the non-triviality of parallel transport of vectors as we discussed it earlier. Like when you stand on the North Pole and you walk towards the South, always parallel transporting, then you walk along the equator, always parallel transporting, walk back, and so on. At the end, you arrive at the same point where you started, but your direction has changed. This is what is measured by the curvature map, because this is basically a parallelogram that you walk. You walk in the x1 direction, then you walk in the x2 direction, always parallel transporting along, and then you walk back in the x2 direction, walk back in the x1 direction, so you're walking a parallelogram, and all the while, you are parallel transporting a vector Xi3. And then you ask, okay, how much is that different from the vector that I, the end result, how much is that different from the vector that I started with? The difference between the two is the output of the curvature map. So it maps, it tells you how much a vector's direction changes as you walk an infinitesimal parallelogram. The torsion map is a little fancier. It is checking whether a parallelogram closes at all. You could have a situation where you walk infinitesimally in Xi1 direction, then infinitesimally in Xi2 direction, then back in Xi2 direction, back in Xi1 direction, and you don't even arrive back where you started. If that's the case, then we say that the manifold has torsion. You can think of this a little bit like a, think of it as a crystal. Imagine you have a crystal, and if it's just a rectangular lattice, the whole crystal is just a rectangular lattice, you can think of it as having no curvature. Parallel transport is pretty trivial in this, and so on. But if you now deform the crystal, so you know, you somehow tweak and twist it and hold it in place now in a deformed way, then you can imagine how parallel transport of a vector now becomes non-trivial in the crystal. That would be captured by the curvature map. But if you overdo it, you can actually have some slippage going on in that crystal, so that as you walk along one of the planes of the crystal, you basically go up a staircase like this. Right? So you could have that as you walk in some direction, other direction, and then reverse, you don't end up where you started, but instead you end up one layer higher, right? Because there's some sort of a defect in there. And that would be captured by the torsion map. It turns out that space-time allows, that differential geometry allows for the description of this, but we won't do much in regards to torsion because there's no evidence that nature has any torsion. Space-time has torsion. Not for lack of trying. Einstein spent the last 20 years or so of his life figuring out whether torsion describes electromagnetism. And the answer is no, it doesn't. But it's been worked on a lot, and there's no evidence that, perhaps unfortunately, that it does describe anything in nature. So it's a strange thing that mathematics allows for torsion, and physics doesn't seem to use it. It's even stranger because quantum mechanically, we would expect that whatever is not explicitly forbidden, virtual paths at least would try out. So one could imagine that space-time quantum fluctuates into space-times that have torsion. Lots of things to explore. I think we're done with the lecture. If there are further questions, I'd be happy to answer them.